The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. My name is Ben Pfeiffer, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Max Carlin. Max, how's it going?
I'm doing all right, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited because we have our final set of episodes before the long-awaited, the very, very, very long-awaited 2020 NBA Draft. We are going to talk about our final draft boards, go over all things boards, talk about our philosophies, the class in general, its strengths and weaknesses, and then the board and the tiers itself. So it's going to be a long one, but just general, you know, class board overview. So let's get into it.
The wait is finally over. Football's in full effect. With many teams strutting their stuff, you might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
Yeah, a couple notes at the top before we get started. One, a bit of promotional material. We are doing our live broadcast on Twitch during the draft. It should be a lot of fun. Drop in. You can ask some questions live. It'll be a good time. Hopefully, better experience than is typically offered on the networks. So check that out. And also, we are recording this on Friday, the 13th. That means that this is before the NBA transaction window opens. So if some sort of huge trades happen that are league altering or draft altering, we do not know about them. They're in the future for us. So if we're kind of conspicuously missing on some big move, that would be the reason why.
Yeah. So, and if any of that happens, assuming it does, and if it will, we'll address that on the live show and have our thoughts and reactions to that, you know, when the draft actually happens. So yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. Come listen to us broadcast our thoughts and our reactions and stuff. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode.
Sure, Ben. So let's talk about boards. They're kind of a silly way to approach the draft because players are different things in different contexts. Players represent different value to different teams. So, how do you feel about putting out a board at all?
I think a lot of just like the value of putting out a board is just, at least for me, is just having a general sense of how I feel about prospects and kind of understanding their role and what they are. I think a lot of that comes with tiers. And just delineating prospects, as you know, we'll get into our specific tiers and the prospects within those tiers for the 2020 draft later. But just understanding, you know, which prospects are creators and which are role players, and you know, which are complementary pieces, and how those players should be ordered. I'm gonna prioritize the genuine creator bets over complementary bets, as I think most people will. But for every team, that's just not consistent. I mean, if you take a team, you know, a team by team big board approach even is probably more useful. Look at a team like the Sixers, would probably have complementary players like Desmond Bane and Malachi Flynn a lot higher than I'd rank them in a vacuum. Doesn't mean that they're better prospects. It's just one, that's a need that they fit. And that's a context where they can succeed and hit their high outcome. I think that's the big thing missing with a big board. It's not necessarily fit. It's the context at which fit determines, you know, player development and how a player actually, which outcome a player and a prospect can actually hit. Yeah, it's more than, you know, X player is higher on the board because he fits better on this team. It's this player, if he goes to a team lower down, will have a better chance of reaching a ceiling because of their context. And that's something that's kind of missing with the board. And I mean, it's just a very there's inherent complications with, you know, ordinal rankings. Like, how much better is like 1 than 2 than 3 or 3 to 5 or 40 to 80? Because, you know, the way the talent curve works is the difference between, you know, the first and 10th best prospect is so much wider than the 40th and 80th best prospect. And you can try to abate that a little bit with tiers, but still, like, there's only so much you can really learn about how much better prospects are than each other by just a numeral ranking. So there's lots of problems with board. A lot of it, I think, is one, just like for like presentation as well to like the outside world as well of your thoughts. But I mean, I think that acknowledging that it's overly simplistic and that, you know, you need to be thinking a little more deep and complex about role and context than a board can really offer.
Yeah, I think some of those issues can be addressed by making a post-draft board. So accounting for the context that these players are going to find themselves in, you know, a very salient example is, you know, Tyrese Haliburton. If he winds up on the Suns, I'm probably going to think more highly of his chances to realize a high end outcome than I will if he winds up on the Pistons. Just because I think that he'll be in a role that's more suited to his abilities. So I think that you can address some of those concerns with a post-draft board with a bit more information there. And that's something I think we'll definitely be doing in addition to our final boards. But the other thing that a board doesn't account for is that it's a static thing, and the draft is very dynamic, because you're kind of constantly accounting for opportunity cost, for scarcity. It's something that we really got at, I think, with our best plays episodes, and would definitely recommend that people check those out if they're kind of interested in thinking about players this way. But, you know, if you're a wing needy team, or not even a wing needy team, if you're just a team that believes that you really need to stock up on wings, and you get to the, you know, 16th, 17th pick, and Vassell and Okoro are gone, you're kind of out of options. Like, you by virtue of scarcity, you kind of like would have to take Josh Green or someone like that if that's what you're looking to acquire and that's what you think is valuable in the league. So these things are changing as the draft progresses. They're changing as you draft people. I know we both did the rights to Rookie Sanchez round table for our pal Sixers Adam. And one of the questions was about sort of stockpiling at a position of need. And I think that could be a worthwhile approach, certainly. Take a lot of shots at a really high leverage spot. But that's dynamic also. What if you get to the point where you have three of these guys? Is the next one going to diminish developmental resources so much for the first three that it you know, actually has negative marginal value to add that fourth guy at the same position? So it's, I don't think that a static board is well suited to what is a very, very dynamic process.
Yeah, and that same concept works in reverse. I mean, you talk about all of the kind of like the complementary guards in this class around the late first, early second ring. You know, your Nico Mannion, Devin Dotson, Tyrell Terry, Cassius Winston, Trey Jones, all of these players. There's a lot of them. And beyond the point of, you know, backup guards or small guards who aren't stars needing to be really, really good and exceptional to bring special value, like, you know, beyond just our issues with drafting those type of players highly and spending real value on them, if there's just so many of them, like, it's probably worth waiting. I mean, if you have to take someone like, I don't know, just like Tyrell Terry, maybe early 20s, but you could get Cassius Winston in the 40s, then I'm taking Cassius Winston I'm waiting to get Cassius every single time. Even if I think Tyrell Terry's, you know, slightly better of a prospect, there's not that much of a difference to make it worth drafting him high. And you know, that gives teams more options in terms of trade downs and trade outs and moving around. And then one more thing a board can't really take into account is trade value as well. I mean, there's definitely some of that you can price in. But, you know, prospects like a prospect like James Wiseman, who even if in a vacuum, we're not huge fans of relative to consensus, is one going to have a leash because he's going to be a top pick. He's going to get chances. He's going to be allowed to fail and make mistakes and stick around. And because he has the number one pick tag attached to him, not only because he is toolsy and, you know, has what the NBA looks for, he's going to have much more trade value than someone, you know, like Xavier Tillman, if they went like 17th or in the 20s or in the early second. That's just another, yeah, just one more point that, you know, boards, you can't, it's hard to factor that in. And like, if even if you do price it in, like, are you keeping that consistent across your board? Like, are you valuing trade value for every single prospect? So that's just another, you know, factor that boards can't really account for.
Yeah, and I think that the general response to I guess fixing boards while still putting out something that like you said, I mean, people want, and it's a useful tool to give a general idea of who you like and don't like. The answer is tiers, and we'll get into ours in more depth later. But what does a tier distinction mean to you?
I mean, a tier distinction mainly to me is a way to kind of delineate larger gaps in quality of talent in the draft. Like I said, the talent curve is a real thing in the draft, as where, you know, it's kind of like a bell curve, but something with a tail falling off at the end, to where, you know, your first overall picks are, you know, these incredible, generally, you know, maybe not in this draft, but these high level prospects, franchise changing talents. And then, you know, your 10th overall pick is not that. Someone who, you know, maybe is a great complimentary piece, but definitely isn't that. And the gap in value between those, let's say they're only 9 spots apart on your board, but because of how scarce and important that franchise changing creator is, the value between him and number 10 is massive. On the other hand, you know, your 40th and your 80th ranked prospects, while yes, they're 40 spots apart, they're likely both going to be role player gambles or fringe NBA bets, just because of, you know, there's a lot more of those type of prospects than the real stars. So, you know, that's a way, as towards the top of the draft, you're likely going to have a few small tiers. And as the draft goes down, your tiers are going to get bigger, and then you're probably going to have one or two really big tiers towards the end. So that's the main value to me of tiers, is kind of illustrating those larger dips in talent in the draft. And the other way is kind of to classify different roles of players and different, you know, definitions of where I want to take guys. It's not like I have all of the creator bets in tier one, or all of the high leverage complimentary bets in tier two, and the fringe role bets in tier three. But I think it's instructive to kind of try to label your tiers, which is, you know, what I know Max tries to do, by kind of, you know, what type of players we value in that range. Like the fringy, the flawed creator is more valuable than the very good complimentary piece is more valuable than the solid complimentary piece / high upside bet is more valuable than the rotation bet. So that those are kind of the two main ways that, you know, I use tiers on my own board to help give it a little more, you know, nuance and try to add some of that context that a pure ordinal ranking lacks.
How firm are you in your opposition to reaching down a tier with higher tier players available?
I think it depends. I think generally decently firm, but I think it's silly to always have hard and fast rules. Like, I think, especially in this draft or the top of the draft, like my tier one is LaMelo Ball and Killian Hayes, but I would not be opposed to certain teams, if they landed number one, taking someone like Anthony Edwards or even like Devin Vassell or Isaac Okoro in certain situations. So I would say like fairly firm-ish, but still, like, depending on context and what you need, I think tiers can always be broken, and it's more of a reflection, again, like, not, yes, it's a reflection of quality of talent and like the gaps between you know, just the gaps between prospects, but that still doesn't really account for context and team need and, you know, certain special situations. So I would say there definitely is room to break tiers and reach for someone lower if it's the right pick.
I tried to make mine pretty firm by having half tiers. So having a 1A, 1B, where I think that there's a grouping that I think is distinctly better, but in the absolute perfect situation, could see reaching across tiers. Lower down, I've got full tier distinctions that I could see broken and wouldn't hate, but would be pretty opposed to. So for me, I tried to make them pretty firm. I think that that's like a sensible way to present things, that everyone within a tier, I see a case, I see, there are reasons why this player would appeal over another. And you have to evaluate that player, understand what he brings, understand what you're trying to accomplish with a pick, understand your plan for development. And then you can kind of work within that tier. But I tried to make mine pretty firm, which is not to say that, you know, if on my board you reached across tiers and took Tyrell Terry over Killian Tilly or something, I wouldn't say that that's the worst decision ever, but I think that I feel pretty firm in not crossing those tiers and sort of enabled that with the half tiers.
Yeah.
Now, moving on, I guess, from the concept of ranking and presentation of those. Should we do a brief discussion of our evaluation philosophy, especially given that we've got some new listeners for sure in the lead up to the draft. Ben, what do you value in the draft?
I mean, I think the first and foremost thing we have to talk about is the thing that you need in the draft is stars, and those stars most often the stars who can drive championship offense win based on advantage creation. So looking for high level advantage creation is kind of the first thing I'm always looking for in this, primarily in primary prospects. Because just being able to break down that defense initially, whether you have an elite first step or an elite handle to discard defenders or elite strength to push defenders back and force rotations, that advantage creation, I think, is the most important thing to me. That, especially in primary prospects and mostly in primary prospects, that you're looking for is, can this prospect bend a set defense and force rotations? Because that's how NBA offense happens, and that's how you generate scores, and obviously that's how you win basketball games and win championships. So that's the most important thing that I look for in primaries, which are the most important thing, archetype to search for in the draft. Beyond that, I think the trait that I prioritize most is intelligence. We talk about it in terms of feel for the game, basketball IQ, not only for, role players, but for primaries as well, because once you get past that initial advantage creation, decision-making is absolutely critical. All of the best stars are high-level decision makers. You have to, beyond being able to generate the advantage, you need to be able to make the right decision to see the whole floor and understand what the right pass is and where to place it and whether that pass is even a good idea or if it's a better idea to go score himself. I mean, just being able to process the game quickly and make good, consistent decisions is critical for primaries and also critical for, more complementary pieces on both ends. Offensively, we talk about role players needing more. Good role players need to do more than shoot spot up threes. They have to make strong decisions, have to make quick decisions, make the right decisions, make them quickly, especially in the playoffs as windows tighten and defenses get stronger and tighter. Being able to see the floor and make critical decisions, I think it's crucial. And then defensively as well, just making correct rotations and timing things correctly is. And seeing actions unfold quickly is huge. I think there's two components of that. There's feel, and then there's IQ, which are often kind of nebulous. I tend to think of feel as like more instinctual, and IQ as more learned and studied. Like IQ being, having studied a pick and roll coverage and how to beat it, and feels is understanding angles and spacing and timing and kind of beating it with instinct. I think it's probably the most difficult thing to really get to a high level, I think it's kind of a thing. It goes hand in hand with wiring, where you kind of have it or you don't, I think. And it's really difficult to improve. Obviously, you know, passing is separate from feel and IQ. They're linked but separate. You can teach someone to make basic passes. Like we talked about with someone like Onyeka Okongwu plenty on this pod. Like you can teach him to make a kick to the short roll or a lay down pass off of that. And that's like just a basic robotic decision, but making high level reads with speed and dexterity that, you know, go against that really dictate what defenses do, and high level defenses, that is really rare. So those are kind of the two main prongs. I mean, there are so many other things as well, which I'm sure we'll get into, but I'll let you go with some of your things as well.
Yeah. I still think paramount for me is intelligence, but I think it's maybe more fair to phrase it as like basketball understanding, because you don't need to be Tyrese Halliburton, but you have to have a clue of what's going on the floor, and that applies to every single role. Like if you are a spot up threat and closeout attacker, like at the very least you need to be incredibly quick off the catch, and then you need to be reliable in what you're doing once you step inside the three-point arc. Obviously, for a creator, you need to be able to read the floor, you need to be able to anticipate, you need to be able to manipulate, you need to understand you need to understand like the game theory of how people are going to react to your actions. So there's a huge amount of intelligence required there. Defensively, you need to recognize action based off of pattern recognition that you very possibly haven't seen before. You need to just pick out things that are reminiscent of the things you have seen before and figure out what's going to happen before it happens in order to make a play on it. Like that's pretty hard to do. There's just a high amount of intelligence that's required for every single role on a basketball floor. And then, yeah, I mean, it's like little feel things like knowing the angle to set a screen at, when to flip it, finding opportunities to screen and cut off the ball. These are things that matter so much. And I think that they're only really learnable through massive amounts of game experience, that by the time you get to the NBA, it's not enough time. This is something that has to be developed through the first 18, 20 years of a prospect's life. It's probably advantage creation. If you need to have ways to compromise the defense if you're a creator prospect, and that's the most valuable commodity there is because they drive offense. And just generally valuing functional basketball abilities. So, you know, I care a lot about athletic tools, but Max Vert in an empty gym to me is not like a relevant basketball athletic tool. Your 1 foot contact leaping is a very important athletic tool. Your a first step, or just I guess short area burst in general, is a massively important athletic tool. I don't much care about 3-quarter court sprints though. So functional basketball abilities, whether that's, you know, these athletic abilities, ability to break guys down with a handle, strength, of course. All of these tools, I just want to see them in a basketball setting as opposed to a combine setting. Just generally, I care about accounting for scarcity, accounting for team building, and investing in players that will push you closer toward a championship. So that's, you know, I'm definitely on the lower end of someone like James Wiseman or Obi Toppin. I think that they kind of impose restrictions upon you that don't necessarily bring you closer toward a championship, even if they make you a better team. They could make you a better team, but I don't particularly care personally about going from being a 33-win team to a 45-win team. I'm much more interested in raising that ceiling. I think that about covers it for what I'm looking to do in the draft.
Yeah. A couple more things that I wanted to value to mention. One, I mean, you kind of alluded to this with team construction. It's really important to think about role not only the role that a prospect is currently playing, but the role that a prospect is going to take on at the next level, and what role they should and are most optimal at the next level. We'll bring up Tyrese Haliburton again because he's such a salient example for so many different philosophical prongs. Who is Tyrese Haliburton, a primary offensive engine at Iowa State, who, you know, was efficient as a scorer and a shooter. But when you, you know, understand that he is a limited ball handler, burst, strength, the finishing volume, and just effectiveness in translation is not going to be good enough. You can't project him into, you know, a point guard in quotations or just offensive engine role. You know, understanding that Haliburton, his best role is going to be as an off-ball kind of linking player, taking advantage of his spot-up prowess and running secondary pick and rolls, playmaking and transition, all of that. Understanding that going lower benefits him, and certain teams are going to be better equipped to maximize him in that role. And if he goes to a team that misuses him and kind of treats him as a primary, that he's less likely to hit a high outcome. That brings me a nice segue to outcomes. That kind of a ranking of a player for me is not ranking like one of their outcome. Like I'm not ranking, like we obviously did ceiling boards and we did a ceiling board on this podcast and we did a medium board. Those are useful exercises to me, just because considering ceiling and considering median are crucial, but you have to consider everything at once. Kind of like creating an expected value of what outcome I think a prospect is most likely to hit. Obviously, you know, again, a lot of that depends on context, and a re-rank is important there, but just kind of figuring out where a prospect, you know, what their realistic ceiling is, how likely they are to hit that ceiling, what their realistic floor is, how likely they are to hit that floor, and what has to happen for a prospect to hit his floor or his ceiling. And then the last thing that we value a ton is development arc. Just tracking a player's development over a longitudinal period of time. Something we've talked about plenty on this podcast with someone like Killian Hayes, who's made significant strides in many facets of his game just over the last calendar year, that if you just watched Ulm Killian Hayes, yes, you saw a very good player, but you don't understand the level to which he has drastically improved. And, you know, for those players who are young and skilled and intelligent and drastically improving, it's solid to bet on them to continue on that positive positive development arc. And then, you know, kind of opposite for, you know, prospects who stagnate, prospects who, you know, maybe especially older prospects who don't get better year over year and don't improve their skills or their production, that's a concern. So those are the other like more minor prongs and facets of my draft philosophy that I wanted to bring up. But I think that about covers it.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up development arc. It's really important. And I outlined this poorly and forgot to put it in there.
It's okay.
Yeah, for role, considering what role a guy can fill at the next level is very important, but also considering the value of that role. Like we've said, creators are highly valuable. Defensive anchor bigs. I mean, one of the big things for me this year has been really emphasizing the value of coverage versatile bigs. Is kind of like the selling point for Onyeka Okongwu, that those guys are really, really hard to find and are big-time ceiling raisers. So, it's understanding how a guy projects into what very well may be a new role and the value of that role. That you know, the Devon Dotson off-guard slasher point guard sized, who's like okay at defense at best, is not a particularly valuable role, even if he's very good at it. Projecting role, accounting for the value of that role, scarcity. All of that works into it.
The wait is finally over. Football's in full effect. With many teams strutting their stuff, you might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Support for the Prep to Pro NBA Draft podcast comes from Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Jingle balls to the walls, fellas. Listen up. Untrimmed pubes are a thing of the past. It's time to gear up and get yourself the gift of shaving this holiday season. I am talking about the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. The Lawnmower 3.0 comes inside their brand new Perfect Package 3.0, which makes for the perfect gift this holiday season. It's literally everything you need to keep trimmed, cut free, and smelling nice down there. The Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0 also includes the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. You already put deodorant on your armpits. Why are you not putting it on the smelliest part of your body? And yes, your balls stink. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code ARMCHAIR at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code ARMCHAIR. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year.
Yeah, so that's a basic outline of our philosophy. We've done whole episodes on our draft philosophy. I mean, you can check out episodes that we've done. I think our first episode is with PD on philosophical debates in this draft. Our episode with TJ Farrick, I think, is a good point here as well. So plenty of content on philosophy if we're interested. I think now it's time to get into just thoughts, general thoughts, overarching thoughts on the 2020 draft class, kind of harkening back to our very first episode.
I know we've totally come full circle.
Yeah. Coming back to our very first episode, many months ago, it seems like forever ago, but it was in this calendar year. So we're going to start now where we began and just talk about strengths, weaknesses, trends with this general draft class, and how it compares to other classes before getting onto, you know, the players and the tiers in specific. So.
All right, this should be easy. Let's get this out of the way. What are the weaknesses of the class, Ben?
Oh, man. Just, you know, we talked about creation and advantage creation as the key thing, as the most valuable commodity. And there just isn't that in this draft, along with just the lack of high-end talent. You'll hear the trope that this draft is a weak draft and all over the place. And that's true. And that's because mainly that beyond depth issues and everything else, that it lacks high-end star talent. Even a class like 2019, which we'll get to later, that was considered weak by many, had that generational creator offensive engine in Zion Williamson. There's nobody like that in this class. As you just watch this class and look at them, there's just not a lot of prospects who really look like high-level NBA advantage creators. And that to me is definitely the main weakness of this class and the main thing that drags it down.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, at the top of the draft, the point is to get franchise-changing talents. And there aren't really any this year. There are, I would think, three guys who are not really close, but kind of close. It's just lacking in a franchise changing talent. That's the object of the top of the draft, which I think we both think it is, or everyone thinks it is, that's a pretty big failing.
I mean, it's difficult because the top two prospects to me, I mean, LaMelo and Killian, LaMelo is not really an advantage creator at this point. He obviously wins with the elite playmaking and the ball handling and hope that he can improve that in time. Killian Hayes has improved as an advantage creator, but being a primary generator of offense is not his main selling point. And then Anthony Edwards, who I don't have in that tier just because who does theoretically have the tools to be a really effective advantage creator with the powerful first step and stuff. Just has so many other questions. It's really rough, and it just lacks that player who can change the direction of a franchise, which is what you want at the top of the draft.
Yeah, there just isn't a guy who marries like elite self creation upside with the ability to drive offense. Like I think LaMelo and Killian can compromise defenses, can manipulate defenses, and are brilliant playmakers. But I have serious concerns about LaMelo having both volume and efficiency. And I have concerns about Killian having volume as a scorer. And then Ant, I think he can have volume as a self creator, but you know the decision making is pretty questionable. As is the efficiency. It's just they're flawed. They're flawed creator prospects, and we'll talk more about that later. But there are not any guys in this class who I think really change the fortunes of the franchise. Onto a smaller concern, but one that annoys me. Is that there are very few of those bigs. There are very few bigs in this class that meet the qualification that I laid out of advancing you toward a championship. The only ones really are Okongwu and Tillman, I think.
And Tilly, if he's healthy.
Tilly, if healthy.
Yeah.
The rest of these guys are pretty situational.
Yeah. Lots of specialists or floaters.
Yeah. There are specialists like Najee, like Jalen Smith.
Precious
for sure. But then there are guys that I think could be pretty valuable, but just they're going to be very situationally constrained, like Toppin and Wiseman. And it's just like, you know.
Anyways, those two I think are you know, textbook floor raisers as well.
Exactly.
Players who elevate a bad team, you know, with skills that aren't really additive to high level basketball, like, you know, but just don't raise the ceiling of a championship level roster with high end talent. And I think that scalability is really important for bigs that aren't like high end stars, which there's no like high end star big men in this class. Those are so rare. Like the rare bigs that can really drive championship offense or are good enough defensively to be star level. So those bigs who aren't, which I think there's very clearly none in this class, have to be scalable. They have to be able to scale with high-end talent and have skills that align with ball-dominant creators, you know, shooting, decision-making, some basic ball handling, coverage versatility. And, you know, that's what you see out of prospects like Onyeka and Tillman and Tilly, who have those additive skills. But even, you know, they have their flaws, and they are really the only bets that – you're kind of trusting to play high leverage minutes at the big spot, which is a shame because those are, you know, really important pieces that just teams aren't going to find in this draft, I think. So.
Did you have any other major weaknesses you wanted to address?
I mean, there weren't any other like the. I mean, I think just general like second round goodness, like in depth of like quality role player bets is one. I think even in relation to like last year's draft or the year before, there just aren't a lot of good second round bets. I think that's more of a minor weakness because the second round is always more dicey. But I think, that's definitely something worth mentioning. There just aren't as many like second round gambles to me that are really exciting, you know, compared to like the last couple of years where I think there's just more standout second round guys that I'm excited about. You know, excited about investing in and swinging on. You know, of course, like that doesn't account for, you know, prospects who will inevitably slip, who, you know, we value higher, and kind of surprises that happen. But no other like major weaknesses.
One that just occurred to me that has recently become a huge weakness, I think, is there are no good second round stash candidates at this point, pretty much.
Yeah.
Because of the late withdrawals of Rokas Jokubaitis, Georgios Kalaitzakis, Archers Kurucs. I'm trying to remember if there were any others, but there were a handful of late withdrawals, and it's tough now. There are not a lot of guys I'm enthused about,
especially for teams that have like a lot of picks, like the Sixers or the Pelicans. Like a lot of teams can't afford to roster all of those picks.
Yeah, they just truly do not have
spots. Yeah, so and you know, there's only like two or maybe three real like enticing stash candidates that are worth anything, you know, beyond like Bomaro, who is like much better than all of these guys. But there's only like a couple real second round stash candidates, which, yeah, I mean, I feel like there tends to be, you know, there might be some that come out kind of surprised, and there are some that, you know, teams will value more than Max and I do, like a Pauly Bua. But
well, and Ben, what we're gonna see, I think, is that some of these pre-stash guys from NCAA, some guys who signed with international teams because of the misaligned schedules now, and are draft eligible, but will be playing for international teams. I think we'll see some of those guys stashed. So, you know, someone like Justinian Jessup, who signed with the Illawarra Hawks. Could definitely see him getting drafted and stashed. And I think that actually makes a lot of sense if it's something that can be done.
Yeah.
I think that's a nice way to make up for losing these stash options. But it stinks nonetheless. Like Jokubaitis, Kalaitzakis in particular. I was like, you know, pretty into them as stash options.
Yeah, I believe strongly in both of them as like solid second round gambles. And even like I didn't like Kurucs as much, but I still do like Kurucs as like a interesting like combo guard wing shooting prospect. And again, like that just lack of options for teams is never a good thing. Expect to probably see a lot of like sold or traded second round picks for nothing if they can't, you know, make something with them. Because again, teams just like can't roster all of the players that they have picks for.
All right, let's move on to strengths. Let's get positive here. So I think the flip side of lacking the top end talent is that like all of the top guys are really like nice complementary talents. And so if you're a team that has your star creator in place already and you get to pick in that like top 15 range or maybe even 20, you're in really good shape because you're going to have available to you guys that have skill sets that complement ball dominant players really well, a bunch of stylistically different players. Like you can get a nuclear shooter like Cole Anthony. You can get a elite guard finisher and guard defender like Tyrese Maxey. You could get an elite, you know, burst guy in RJ Hampton. There are all these different styles of player. Even into the top half of the lottery, you know, you can get a Kongwu as the, you know, the ultimate ceiling raising big. There are just so many options in terms of getting that final piece to tack onto to a core that's already got the main piece. And that's not helpful if you are the Charlotte Hornets and picking third overall, that really stinks. But, you know, if you're the Phoenix Suns picking 10th, that's a pretty awesome position to be in.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like across positions, like you said, all of the different, you know, flavors of complementary guards, from, you know, the shooting of Cole Anthony to, you know, the finishing and defending of Maxey. I mean, it's positionally as well. Like you have some potentially really useful, like complementary fours, like Patrick Williams and Denny Avdija, who, you know, provide that valuable, you know, rim protection from the four spot with, you know, different kinds, but complementary offensive skill set. And then again, like Onyeka is like a like complementary big who I think is, and then even as you go to like higher end prospects like Fassell and Okoro, I think both of those are, you know, fundamentally complementary as well. Like even if I think they have more star and self creation upside than the other complementary prospects, you know, they still, you know, with their defense especially, again, like I talked about earlier, scale really well next to high end talent. Where, you know, that defense adds well, and both of them have skills, you know, Okoro's cutting and his playmaking and his finishing, and then Vassell's shooting, that scales really well with high end talent. And that's just kind of, I think, again, what you need is those valuable skills like shooting, cutting, decision-making, finishing that scale with high end talent.
And it gets to an important philosophical point, that if you are not good enough to be playing with the ball in your hands, that you need to be adding value in avenues of the game that aren't, you know, playing with the ball in your hands. So, you know, being a guy who is a really potent off the catch attacker or really, really strong relocator or defensive communicator, like the that's how you add value when you're in a complementary role. And there are so many guys who are great at doing that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a huge gap between like the first tier initiators, like, you know, your LeBrons and Lucas and Harden. And then you have your, you know, wrong initiators in quotes, that the types that, you know, again, will drive could drive a pretty good offense, a good team, just not championship level. You know, I think of someone like Zach LaVine as a prime, like, wrong initiator, or even like Donovan Mitchell, maybe at this point in his career. Yeah, and you need, like, you know, it's the question, like, would you rather draft, you know, one of those like wrong initiator types who probably like wins, you know, makes all-star teams and puts up a lot of points per game, or, you know, somebody who is not flashy, who scales into a small role with spot up shooting and cutting and finishing and team defense. And those are all super important. And, you know, again, why we like someone like Isaac Okoro so much, just really adds to the stars that, you know, drive the most of the championship value, but you need other players to complement them and to add things, and talking about additive skills a lot. And that's just like, again, a big strength of this class is, especially for teams picking in like the 10 to 20 range, I think, or even like the 7 to 20 range, there's going to be a ton of strong values just based on the way that, teams are going to value certain prospects. Like, like someone like Tyrese Maxey is a perfect example of just someone who's going to be a really strong complementary value for a team that could already have its star in place.
Yeah, another area this draft is very strong is in its guard depth, and I think that goes throughout the entire draft. I mean, all those guys that we mentioned were as high-end complementary options in that mid-first range, but really through the late first, and there's such a glut of them that I certainly expect that some of these guys are going to fall much lower than they should. And again, a situation where you should definitely check out our best plays episode. But you know, one of this like class of Trey Jones, Cassius Winston, Teo Maledon, Tyrell Terry, they're going to fall well into the second. And you're going to get a great value by simply waiting. I think that's really useful, especially for teams that are going to be operating that area of the draft, because you could just be looking for a steady rotational guard. I mean, think about how much like the Lakers would benefit from having another steady rotational guard. And the same thing is true in the middle of the first, where it's or even into the 20s. You know, if you're Philly and by virtue of guard depth wind up with Cole Anthony sitting there for you at 21, I mean, you've got to be absolutely ecstatic. So the guard depth, I think, is really beneficial.
Yeah, and it goes back to just hearkening to scarcity, as there just are always, especially in this draft, there's just always more good guards than there are, you know, good defensive wings or good mobile big men or, you know, even creators. Like, that's why, you know, I think it is smart, and you'll see a lot of teams waiting to take, you know, a smart team will get someone like, you know, like you said, like a Teo Maledon or like a Nico Mannion or a Tyrell Terry in the 40s, who can be a really solid rotational piece on like a rookie contract. And that's hugely valuable. So yeah, I mean, again, like there are avenues for smart teams to take advantage of the places that this draft is strong, you know, by virtue of waiting and trade downs and other things like that.
Yeah, another area I like, kind of along the same lines, would be the wing gambles. I'm not as enthused about these guys. They're not really like early to mid seconds to me. They're more, I'll take them late on a two-way or sign them as a UDFA. But there are a bunch of guys that I feel pretty comfortable with on two ways, thinking like your Jay Scrubs, Trace Tinkle, Lamine Janae, Trent Forrest,
Josh Hall, like
Josh Hall. Yeah. All of these guys that are going to cost you a 50s pick, which is, you know, essentially a two way or stash, or are going to come as undrafted free agents. I think that there are a lot of worthwhile guys. I think that that's kind of, These fringy wings, I think, are what you should be spending your two ways exactly. on, since there's just such a dearth of wing talent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
draft, I think, it's well set up for people for teams on the margins to spend very little to take some worthwhile flyers on some wing talent.
Yeah, and that's just another philosophy point in terms of, you know, how I believe and we believe you should be drafting late in the second. Even if, you know, a wing gamble like Lamine Janae or, you know, CJ Ellaby or Christian Doolittle or Josh Hall or somebody of that in that vein is, you know, maybe less likely to carve out a spot in the NBA in a career than someone like Peyton Pritchard. I think it's always more valuable to take the wing gamble, because if they do end up hitting and providing some sort of rotation value, then that's a much more scarce and valuable piece than, you know, a solid to decent backup point guard. Again, just late in the second, you're never going to find like a star, or almost never going to find like a star, like a real starter. So just looking for those swings that could turn into something beyond like the safety of maybe like a solid backup point guard is always the way to go to me.
Yeah, it's an important philosophical point that if you're once you're past guards who are exceptional in some regard, you can find those like truly replacement level small guards are eminently available.
Yeah,
replacement level 6-7 guys like don't really exist.
Are rare. I mean,
they're all rostered.
Yeah, so I think the. Another place that this draft is fairly strong is in kind of this like three and rim protection archetype that we're seeing become increasingly popular and necessary in the modern NBA, with, you know, spacing and decision making and defensively with range and ground coverage becoming all the more essential. We talked a little bit about this on our last mailbag episode, I think, And it goes like up and down the draft. I think you have, you know, Patrick Williams and, you know, Patrick Williams is, you know, a main example as a high level one of these really high level rim protector with, you know, age, ancillary skills. I think, like, you know, Denny, if he ends up shooting, falls here, but less three and more other offensive skills. And then there's the glut of prospects like Jaden McDaniels and Tyler Bay and Robert Woodard, who all have flaws, but all, you know, assuming they hit their ceiling and they get the jumper to work out, could you know, find a place as like a seventh man in a rotation, you know, have size, have that ability to protect the rim and, you know, hit a three and attack a closeout. That's, you know, an increasingly valuable position. And there's, you know, quite a few decent bets to fill that role. So another minor strength that I see in this draft.
Yeah, there's nice depth of those guys, and that sort of like interplays with that idea that you can maybe wait on them, and you know, maybe you'll get a Robert Woodard or Tyler Bay well into the second round, and then you're getting one of the what we think is a pretty valuable archetype pretty late by virtue of there just being so many of these guys. And yeah, I like some of the high end ones like Pat Will and Poku are legitimately very worthwhile prospects as well.
Yeah. So I think the last strength that, you know, we've identified is there's just like a lot of really smart players in this draft and like really good passers. Like again, we talked about as a weakness, the top two prospects in this class being, you know, not really adept at advantage creation. At least not to the level that a primary needs, but they are elite playmakers. And even as you go down, you have, you know, like Tyrese Haliburton is a pretty special passer, even like Malachi Flynn, Cassius Winston, even as you go further down. It's such an intelligent group, even beyond the guards. Again, like we value basketball intelligence, but that basketball intelligence and understanding and feel has to come with other skills that complement it. But, you know, just in terms of smart basketball players, there's quite a few in this class.
Yeah, it runs through a lot of the draft. You know, obviously in the top tier, Killian Hayes and LaMelo Ball are really brilliant basketball players. And then through all of these tiers, you know, you have Okoro and Vassell are brilliant on the wing. You know, all the way through, you get into the late first, and you've got Tillman and Tilly, and even into the second, that there are some very, very smart high field players available. So I think that's a major strength of this class. And if you consider that that's one of the more important things for contributing to winning basketball, that's good. It's just, you know, you do need other skills. You need physical abilities to capitalize on that intelligence. And that's kind of where this draft falls flat. But the minds available in the 2020 NBA draft are extraordinarily high end.
All right, so I think we're going to move on here.
Yeah, do you want to cut this as part one, or do you want to keep going?
I think we actually cut it. Yeah,
let's cut this.
Yeah. All right, so this is going to be part one of, you know, our final board overview. Again, we'll again plug our draft broadcast live on Twitch during the draft. So if you want to hear, you know, more of this stuff and more of our thoughts live and some of our, you know, more fun unadulterated reactions, then come check that out. As always, you can follow the pod on Twitter at @prep2propod. Get us everywhere you get podcasts. Follow Max on Twitter at @MaxAcarlin. Follow me at @Ben_Pfeiffer_. And with that, we will see you all next time.